Shafto feels as if his intestines have dissolved and are about to spurt from his body. He closes his eyes, puckers his anal sphincter, and clenches his teeth. The general takes a seat next to him.
"Down the hill," he orders. "Drive towards the sound of the guns."
They have barely gotten onto the road when their progress is blocked by the two jeeps that have been carrying all the brass up from the airfield. They now sit empty on the road, their doors hanging open, engines still running. The general reaches across in front of Shafto and honks the horn. Colonels and brigadier generals begin to emerge from the shadows of the jungle, like some especially bizarre native tribe, clutching their attaché cases talismanically. They salute the general, who ignores them testily.
"Move my vehicles,"
he intones, jabbing at them with the stem of his pipe.
"This is the road. The parking lot is that way."
The Zeros come back for a third pass. Shafto now realizes, as perhaps the general has, that these pilots are not the best. It is late in the war and all the good pilots are dead. Consequently, they do not line their trajectories up properly with the road. The strafing trails cut across it diagonally. Still, a bullet bores through the engine block of one of the jeeps. Hot oil and steam spray out of it.
"Come on, push it out of the way,"
the general says. Shafto instinctively begins to climb out of the jeep, but the general yanks him back with a word.
"Shafto, I need you to drive this vehicle."
Wielding his pipe stem like a conductor's baton, the general gets his staff back out on the road and they begin shoving the ruined jeep into the jungle. Shafto makes the mistake of inhaling through his nose and gets a strong diarrheal whiff. At least one of these officers has shit his pants. Shafto's still trying hard not to do the same and probably would have if he had pushed the jeep. The Zeros are trying to line up for another strafing run, but a few American fighter planes have now appeared on the scene, which complicates matters. Shafto maneuvers them through a gap between the remaining jeep and a huge tree, then guns it down the road. The general hums to himself for a while, then says,
"What's your wife's name?"
"Gory."
"What?"
"I mean, Glory."
"Ah, good. Good Filipina name. Filipinas are the most beautiful women in the world, don't you think?"
Experienced world traveler Bobby Shafto screws up his face and begins to review his experiences in a systematic way. Then he realizes that the general probably does not actually want his considered opinion. Of course, the general's wife is American, so this could be tricky.
"I guess the woman you love is always the most beautiful," Shafto finally says.
The general looks mildly pissed off.
"Of course, but..."
"But if you don't really give a shit about them, the Filipinas are the most beautiful, sir,"
Shafto says. The general nods.
"No, you're a boy. What's his name, then?"
Shafto swallows hard and thinks fast. He doesn't even know if he has a kid. He fabricated that to make his line sound better. And even if he does, the chances are only 50-50 that it's a boy. But if he does have a boy, he knows already what the name will be.
"His name, well, sir, his name, and I hope you don't mind this, but his name is Douglas."
The general grins delightedly and cackles, slapping the anti-aircraft shell in his lap for emphasis. Shafto flinches. When they arrive at the airfield, a full-fledged dogfight is in progress overhead. The place is deserted because everyone except them is hiding behind sandbags. The general has Shafto drive up and down the length of the field, stopping at each gun emplacement so that he can peer over the barrier.
"There's the fellow,"
the general finally says, pointing his swagger stick at a gun on the opposite side of the runway.
"I just saw him poking his head out, yammering on the telephone."
Shafto guns it across the runway. A flaming Zero, traveling at about half the speed of sound, impacts the runway a few hundred feet away and disintegrates into a howling cloud of burning spare parts that come skittering and rolling and bounding across the runway in their general direction. Shafto falters. The general yells at him. Reckoning that he can't avoid what he can't see, Shafto turns into the storm. Having seen this kind of thing happen before, he knows that the first thing to come their way will be the engine block, a red-hot tombstone of fine Mitsubishi iron. And indeed, there it is, one of its exhaust manifolds still dangling from it like a broken wing, spinning end over end and spading huge divots out of the runway with each bounce. Shafto swings wide around it. He identifies the fuselage and sees that it is plowed to a stop already. He looks for the wings. They broke up into a few large pieces that are slowing down rapidly. But the tires broke loose from the landing gear and are bounding along towards them, burning wheels of red fire. Shafto maneuvers the jeep between them, guns it across a small patch of flaming oil, then makes another hard turn and continues towards their objective. The explosion of the Zero sent everyone back down behind their sandbags. The general has to climb out of the jeep and peer over the top of the barrier. He holds the anti-aircraft shell up above his head.
"Say, Captain,"
he says in his perfect radio announcer voice.
"This arrived on my end table with no return address, but I believe it came from your unit."
The captain's helmeted head pops into view over the top of the sandbags as he jumps to attention. He is gaping at the shell.
"Would you please look after it and make sure that it has been properly defused?"
The general tosses the shell at him sideways like a watermelon, and the captain barely has the presence of mind to catch it.
"Carry on," the general says. "Let's see if we can actually shoot down some nips next time."
He waves disparagingly at the burning wreckage of the Zero and climbs into the jeep with Shafto.
"All right, back up the hill, Shafto."
"Yes, sir."
"Now, I know that you hate me because you are a Marine."
Officers like it when you pretend to be straight with them.
"Yes, sir, I do hate you, sir, but I do not feel that this need be an impediment to our killing some nips together, sir."
"We agree. But in the mission I have in mind for you, Shafto, killing nips will not be the primary objective."
Shafto's a bit off balance now.
"Sir, with all due respect, I believe that killing nips is my strong point."
"I don't doubt it. And that is a fine skill for a Marine. Because in this war, a Marine is a first-rate fighting man under the command of admirals who don't know the first thing about ground warfare, and who think that the way to win an island is to hurl their men directly into the teeth of the Nip's prepared defenses."
The general pauses here, as if giving Shafto an opportunity to respond. But Shafto says nothing. He is remembering the stories that his brothers told him on Kwajalein, about all the battles they had fought on small Pacific islands, precisely as the general describes.
"Consequently, a Marine must be very good at killing nips, as I have no doubt you are. But now, Shafto, you are in the army. And in the army, we actually have certain wonderful innovations, such as strategy and tactics, which certain admirals would be well advised to acquaint themselves with. And so your new job, Shafto, is not simply to kill nips, but to use your head."
"Well, I know that you probably think I'm a stupid jarhead, General, but I do think that I have a good head on my shoulders."
"And on your shoulders is exactly where I would like it to stay,"
the General says, slapping him heartily on the back.
"What we are trying to do now is to create a tactical situation that is favorable to us. Once that is accomplished, the actual killing of nips can be handled by more efficient means such as aerial bombardment, mass starvation, and the like. It will not be necessary for you to personally cut the throat of every nip you run into, as eminently qualified as you might be for such an operation."
"Thank you, General, sir."
"We have millions of Filipino guerrillas and hundreds of thousands of troops to handle the essentially quotidian business of turning live nips into dead, or at least captive nips. But in order to coordinate their activities, I need intelligence. That will be one of your missions. But the country is already crawling with my spies, and so it will be a secondary mission."
"And the primary mission, sir?"
"Those Filipinos need leadership. They need coordination. And perhaps, most of all, they need fighting spirit."
"Fighting spirit, sir?"
"There are many reasons for the Filipinos to be down in the dumps. The Nips have not been kind to them.
and although I have been very busy here in New Guinea preparing the springboard for my return, the Filipinos don't know about any of this, and many of them probably think I have forgotten about them entirely. Now it is time to let them know I'm coming, that I shall return, but soon." Shafto snickers, thinking that the general is engaging in some self-mocking humor here. Yes, a bit of irony. But then he notes that the general does not seem especially amused.
"Stop the vehicle!" he shouts.
Shafto parks the jeep at the apex of a switchback, where they can look northwest across the outermost reaches of the Philippine Sea. The general extends one arm toward Manila, hands slightly cupped, palm canted upward, gesturing like a Shakespearean actor in a posed photograph.
"Go there, Bobby Shafto," says the general. "Go there and tell them that I am coming."
Shafto knows his cue, and he knows his line.
"Sir, yes, sir."
Origin. From the point of view of admittedly privileged white male technocrats, such as Randy Waterhouse and his ancestors, the Palouse was like one big live-in laboratory for nonlinear aerodynamics and chaos theory. Not much was alive there, and so one's observations were not forever being clouded by trees, flowers, fauna, and the ploddingly linear and rational endeavors of humans. The Cascades blocked any of those warm, moist, refreshing Pacific breezes, harvesting their moisture to carpet ski areas for dewy-skinned Seattleites, and diverting what remained north to Vancouver or south to Portland. Consequently, the Palouse had to get its air shipped down in bulk from the Yukon in British Columbia. It flowed across the blasted volcanic scabland of central Washington in, Randy supposed, a more or less continuous laminar sheet that, when it hit the rolling Palouse country, ramified into a vast system of floods, rivers, and rivulets diverging around the bald, swelling hills and recombining in the sheer declivities. But it never recombined exactly the way it was before. The hills had thrown entropy into the system. Like a handful of nickels and a batch of bread dough, this could be kneaded from place to place, but never removed. The entropy manifested itself as swirls and violent gusts and ephemeral vortices. All of these things were clearly visible because all summer the air was full of dust or smoke, and all winter it was full of wind-blown snow. Whitman had dust devils, snow devils in the winter, in the way that medieval Guangzhou presumably had rats. Randy followed dust devils to school when he was a kid. Some were small enough that you could almost cup them in your hand, and some were like small tornadoes, 50 or 100 feet high, that would appear on hilltops or atop shopping malls like biblical prophecies, as filtered through the low-budget SFX technology and painfully literal-minded eye of a 50s epic film director. They at least scared the bejesus out of newcomers. When Randy got bored in school, he would look out at the window and watch these things chase each other around the empty playground. Sometimes a roughly car-sized dust devil would glide across the four-square courts and between the swing sets, and scored direct hit on the jungle gym, which was an old-fashioned, unpadded, child-paralyzing unit, hammered together by some kind of Dark Ages ironmonger and planted in solid concrete. A real school of hard knocks, survival of the fittest one. The dust devil would seem to pause as it enveloped the jungle gym. It would completely lose its form and become a puff of dust that would begin to settle back down to the ground as all heavier-than-air things really ought to. But then suddenly the dust devil would reappear on the other side of the jungle gym and keep going. Or perhaps two dust devils would spin off in opposite directions. Randy spent plenty of time chasing and carrying out impromptu experiments on dust devils while walking to and from school, to the point of getting bounced off the grill of a shrieking Buick once he chased a roughly shopping cart-sized one into the street in an attempt to climb into the center of it. He knew that they were both fragile and tenacious. You could stomp down on one of them, and sometimes it would just dodge your foot or swirl around it and keep going. Other times, like if you tried to catch one in your hands, it would vanish. But then you'd look up and see another one just like it 20 feet away, running away from you. The whole concept of matter spontaneously organizing itself into grotesquely improbable and yet indisputably self-perpetuating and fairly robust systems sort of gave Randy the willies later on, when he began to learn about physics. There was no room for dust devils in the laws of physics, at least in the rigid form in which they were usually taught. There is a kind of unspoken collusion going on in mainstream science education. You get your competent but bored, insecure, and hence stodgy teacher talking to an audience divided between engineering students, who are going to be responsible for making bridges that won't fall down or airplanes that won't suddenly plunge vertically into the ground at 600 miles an hour, and who by definition gets sweaty palms and vindictive attitudes when their teacher suddenly veers off track and begins raving about wild and completely non-intuitive phenomena, and physics students, who derive much of their self-esteem from knowing that they are smarter and morally purer than the engineering students, and who, by definition, don't want to hear about anything that makes no fucking sense. This collusion results in the professor saying something along the lines of, "Dust is heavier than air, therefore it falls until it hits the ground. That's all there is to know about dust. The engineers love it because they like their issues dead and crucified, like butterflies under glass. The physicians love it because they want to think they understand everything. No one asks difficult questions. And outside the windows, the dust devils continue to gamble across the campus." Now that Randy's back in Whitman for the first time in several years, watching, because it's winter, ice devils zigzagging across the Christmas-empty streets, he is inclined to take a longer view of the matter, which goes a little something like this. These devils, these vortices, are a consequence of hills and valleys that are probably miles and miles upwind. Basically, Randy, who is blown in from out of town, is in a mobile frame of mind and is seeing things from the wind's frame of reference, not the stationary frame of reference of the little boy who rarely left town. From the wind's frame of reference, it, the wind, is stationary, and the hills and valleys are moving things that crumple the horizon and then rush towards it and then interfere with it and go away, leaving the wind to sort out consequences later on down the line. And some of the consequences are dust or ice devils. If there was more of the stuff in the way, like expansive cities filled with buildings or forests filled with leaves and branches, then that would be the end of the story. The wind would become completely deranged and cease to exist as a unitary thing, and all of the aerodynamic action would be at the incomprehensible scale of microvortices around pine needles and car antennas. A case in point would be the parking lot of Waterhouse House, which is normally filled with cars and therefore a complete wind killer. You aren't going to see dust devils at the downward edge of a full parking lot, just a generalized seepage of dead and decayed wind. But it is Christmas break, and there are all of three cars parked in this space, which doubles as football overflow and hence is about the size of an artillery practice range. The asphalt is dead monitor screen gray. A volatile gas of ice swirls across it as freely as a sheen of fuel on warm water, except where it strikes the icy sarcophagi of these three abandoned vehicles, which have evidently been sitting in this otherwise empty lot for a couple of weeks now, since all of the other cars went away on Christmas break. Each car has become the first cause of a system of wakes and standing vortices that extends downstream for hundreds of yards. The wind here is a glinting abrasive thing, a perpetual face-shredding eyeball-poking tendency in the fabric of space-time, inhabited by vast platinum-blonde arcs of fire that are centered on the low winter sun. Crystalline water is suspended in it all the time, is why. Shards of ice that are smaller than snowflakes, probably just individual legs of snowflakes that have been sheared off and borne into the air as the wind snapped and rattled over the crests of Canadian snow dunes. Once airborne, they stay airborne unless they find themselves ducted into some pocket of dead air, the eye of a vortex, or the still boundary layer of a dead car's parking lot wake. And so, over the weeks, the vortices and standing waves have become visible, like three-dimensional virtual reality renderings of themselves. Waterhouse House rises above this tableau, a high-rise dorm that no person prominent enough to have a dorm named after him would want to have named after him. out of its climactically inappropriate acreage of picture window, shines the same embarrassing greenish light radiated by algae-scummed domestic aquaria. Janitors are going through it with machines the size of hot dog carts, wrangling these mile-long coils of thumb-thick orange power cable, steaming beer vomit and artificial popcorn butter lipids out of the thin gray mats that, when Randy was there, seemed not so much like carpet as references to carpeting or carpet signifiers. When Randy now pulls into the main vehicle entrance, past the big tombstone that says Waterhouse House, he cannot but look straight out the windshield and through the dorm's front windows and straight at a large portrait of his grandfather, Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse, one of a dozen or so figures, mostly departed now, who compete for the essentially bogus title of Inventor of the Digital Computer. The portrait is securely bolted to the cinderblock wall of the lobby and imprisoned under a half-inch thick slab of plexiglass that must be replaced every couple of years as it fogs from repeated scrubbings and petty vandalizations. Seen through this milky cataract, Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse is grimly resplendent in full doctoral robes. He has one foot up on something, his elbow planted on the elevated knee, and has tucked his robes back behind the other arm and planted his fist on his hip. It is meant to be a sort of dynamic leaning into the winds of the future posture, but to Randy, who at the age of 5 was present for his unveiling, it has a kind of incredulous, what the hell are those little people doing down there, vibe about it. Other than the 3 dead cars and their shells of hardened, dust-infused ice, there is nothing in the parking lot save about 2 dozen items of antique furniture and a few other treasures, such as a complete sterling silver tea service and a dark, time-racked trunk. As Randy pulls in with his Uncle Red and his Aunt Nina, he notes that the Shafto boys have discharged the responsibilities for which they will be drawing minimum wage, plus 25% all day long. Namely, they have moved all of these items from where Uncle Jeff and Auntie Anne placed them back to the origin. In a gesture of companionship and or uncle-esque bonhomie, Uncle Red, much to the evident resentment of Aunt Nina, has claimed the Acura's passenger seat, leaving Aunt Nina marooned in the back, where she evidently feels much more physically isolated than the situation would seem to warrant. She makes lateral sliding motions, trying to center the eyes of first Randy, then Uncle Red in the rearview mirror. Randy has taken to relying solely on the outside rearview mirrors during the 10-minute drive over from the hotel, because when he glances at the inside one, he keeps seeing Aunt Nina's dilated pupils aimed down his throat like twin shotgun barrels. The blast of the heater defroster forms a pocket of auditory isolation back there, which, on top of her already prominent feelings of near-animal rage and stress, have left her volatile and obviously dangerous. Randy heads straight for the origin, as in the intersection of the X and Y axes, which is marked by a light pole with its very own multi-ton system of wind-deposited wakes and vortices.
"Look," says Uncle Red, "all we want to accomplish here is to make sure that your mother's legacy, if that is the correct term for the possessions of one who is not actually dead but merely moved into a long-term care facility, is equally divided among her 5 offspring. Am I right?"
This is not addressed to Randy, but he nods anyway, trying to show a united front. He has been grinding his teeth for 2 days straight. The places where his jaw muscles anchored to his skull have become the foci of tremendous radiating systems of surging and pulsing pain.
"I think you'd agree that an equal division is all we want," Uncle Red continues. "Correct?"
After a worrisomely long pause, Aunt Nina nods. Randy manages to glimpse her face in the rearview as she makes another dramatic lateral move, and sees there a look of almost nauseous trepidation, as if this equal division concept might be some Jesuitical snare.
"Now, here's the interesting part," says Uncle Red, who is the chairman of the mathematics department at Oakley College in Macomb, Illinois. "How do we define equal? This is what your brothers and brothers-in-law and Randy and I were debating so late into the night last night.
If we were dividing up a stack of currency, it would be easy, because currency has a monetary value that is printed right on its face, and the bills are interchangeable. No one gets emotionally attached to a particular dollar bill.
This is why we should have an objective appraiser.
But everyone's going to disagree with what the appraiser says, Nina love, says Uncle Red. Furthermore, the appraiser will totally miss out on the emotional dimension, which evidently looms very large here, or so it would seem, based on the, let's say, melodramatic character of the, discussion, if discussion isn't too dignified a term for what some might perceive as more of a, well, catfight that you and your sisters were conducting all day yesterday.
Randy nods almost imperceptibly.
He pulls up and parks next to the furniture that is again clustered around the origin.
At the edge of the parking lot, near where the Y-axis, here denoting perceived emotional value, meets a retaining wall, the Shafto's hot rod sits, all steamed up on the inside.
The question reduces, Uncle Red says, to a mathematical one. How do you divide up an inhomogeneous set of N objects among M people? Or couples, actually. I.e., how do you partition the set into M subsets? S sub 1, S sub 2, up to S sub M, such that the value of each subset is as close as possible to being equal.
It doesn't seem that hard. Aunt Nina begins weakly. She is a professor of Tagmian linguistics.
It is actually shockingly difficult, Randy says.
It is closely akin to the knapsack problem, which is so difficult to solve that it has been used as the basis for cryptographic systems.
And that's not even taking into account that each of the couples would appraise the value of each of the N objects differently,
Uncle Red shouts. By this point, Randy has shut off the car and the windows have begun to steam up. Uncle Red pulls off a mitten and begins to draw figures in the fog on the windshield, using it like a blackboard.
For each of the M people or couples, there exists an N-element value vector, V, where V sub 1 is the value that that particular couple would place on item number 1, according to some arbitrary numeration system, and V sub 2 is the value they would place on item number 2, and so on all the way up to item number N. These M vectors, taken together, form a value matrix. Now, we can impose the condition that each vector must total up to the same amount, i.e., we can just arbitrarily specify some notional value for the entire collection of furniture and other goods and impose the condition that the sum from I equals 1 to N of V sub I equals tau, where tau is a constant.
But we might all have different opinions as to what the total value is as well, says Aunt Nina, gamely.
That has no impact mathematically, Randy whispers.
It is just an arbitrary scaling factor,
Uncle Red says witheringly. This is why I ended up agreeing with your brother Tom, though I didn't at first, that we should take a cue from the way he and the other relativistic physicists do it, and just arbitrarily set tau equals one, which forces us to deal with fractional values, which I thought some of the ladies, present company excluded, of course, might find confusing, but at least it emphasizes the arbitrary nature of the scaling factor and helps to eliminate that source of confusion.
Uncle Tom tracks asteroids in Pasadena for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
There's the Gomer-Ballstrud console, Aunt Nina exclaims, rubbing a hole in the fog on her window and then continuing to orbitally rub away with the sleeve of her coat as if she is going to abrade an escape route through the safety glass.
Just sitting out in the snow.
It's not actually precipitating, Uncle Red says. This is just blowing snow. It is absolutely bone dry, and if you go out and look at the console, or whatever you call it, you will find that the snow is not melting on it at all, because it has been sitting out in the youth store ever since her mother moved to the managed care facility, and it is equilibrated to the ambient temperature, which I think we can all testify is well below 0 Celsius.
Randy crosses his arms over his abdomen, leans his head back, and closes his eyes. The tendons in his neck are as stiff as sub-zero silly putty and resist painfully.
That console was in my bedroom from the time I was born until I left for college, Aunt Nina says. By any decent standard of justice, that console is mine.
Well, that brings me to the breakthrough that Randy and Tom and Jeff and I finally came up with at about 2 a.m., namely that the perceived economic value of each item, as complicated as that is in and of itself, viz. The knapsack problem, is only one dimension of the issues that have got us all on such a jagged emotional edge. The other dimension, and here I really do mean dimension in a Euclidean geometry sense, is the emotional value of each item. That is, in theory, we could come up with a division of the set of all pieces of furniture that would give you, Nina, an equal share. But such a division might leave you, love, just deeply, deeply unsatisfied because you didn't get that console, which, though it's obviously not as valuable as, say, the grand piano, has much greater emotional value to you.
I don't think it's out of the question that I would commit physical violence in order to defend my rightful ownership of that console, Aunt Nina says, suddenly reverting to a kind of dead-voiced, frigid calm.
But that's not necessary, Nina, because we have created this whole setup here just so you can give your feelings the full expression they deserve.
Okay, what do I do? Aunt Nina says, bolting from the car.
Randy and Uncle Red hastily gather up their gloves and mittens and hats and follow her out. She is now hovering over the console, watching the dust of ice swirl across the dark but limpid, virtually glowing surface of the console in the turbulent wake of her body, forming little Mandelbrotian epi-epi-epi vortices.
As Jeff and Ann did before us, and the others will do afterwards, we are going to move each of these items to a specific position, as in XY coordinates in the parking lot. The X-axis runs this way,
Uncle Red says, facing the Waterhouse House and holding his arms out in a cruciform attitude,
and the Y-axis this way.
He toddles around 90 degrees so that one of his hands is now pointing at the Shaftos Impala.
Perceived financial value is measured by X. The farther in that direction it is, the more valuable you think it is. You might even assign something a negative X value if you think it has negative value, e.g. that overstuffed chair over there, which might cost more to reupholster than it is actually worth. Likewise, the Y-axis measures perceived emotional value. Now, we have established that the console has extreme emotional value to you, and so I think that we can just go right ahead and move it down the line over to where the Impala is located.
Can something have negative emotional value?
Aunt Nina says, sourly and probably rhetorically.
If you hate it so much that just owning it would cancel out the emotional benefits of having something like the console, then yes,
Uncle Red says. Randy hoists the console onto his shoulder and begins to walk in a positive Y direction. The Shafto boys are available to hump furniture at a moment's notice, but Randy needs to mark a bit of territory here, just to indicate that he is not without some masculine attributes himself. And so he ends up carrying more furniture than he probably needs to. Back at the origin, he can hear Red and Nina going at it.
I have a problem with this, Nina says. What's to prevent her from just putting everything down at the extreme Y-axis, claiming that everything is terribly emotionally important to her?
Her, in this case, can only mean Aunt Rachel, the wife of Tom. Rachel is a multi-ethnic East Coast urbanite who is not blessed or afflicted with the obligatory Waterhouseian diffidence, and so has always been regarded as a sort of living incarnation of rapacity, a sucking maw of need. The worst-case scenario here is that Rachel somehow goes home with everything, the grand piano, the silver, the china, the Gomer Ballstrud dining room set, hence the need for elaborate rules and rituals, and a booty division system that is mathematically provable as fair.
That's where tau sub E and tau sub dollar sign enter into it,
Uncle Red says soothingly.
All of our choices will be mathematically scaled so that they add up to the same total values on both the emotional and financial scales. So if someone clumped everything together in the extreme corner, then after scaling, it'd be as if they never expressed any preferences at all.
Randy nears the steamed-up Impala. One of the doors makes a crackling noise as superannuated weather stripping peels away from steel. Robin Shafto emerges, breathes into his cupped hands, and takes a parade rest position,
signifying that he is available to discharge any responsibilities out here on the Cartesian coordinate plane. Randy looks up over the Impala and the retaining wall and the ice-clogged xeriscape above that and into the lobby of Waterhouse House, where Amy Shafto has her feet up on a coffee table and is looking through some of the extremely sad cayuse-related literature that Randy bought for Avi. She looks down and smiles at him and just barely, he thinks, restrains the impulse to reach up and twirl one finger around her ear.
"That's good, Randy,"
shouts Uncle Red from the Origin.
"Now we need to give it some X."
Meaning that the console is not devoid of economic value either. Randy does a right face and begins to walk into the positive X, positive Y quadrant, counting the yellow lines.
"Give it about 4 parking spaces. That's good."
Randy plonks the console down, then pulls a pad of graph paper out of his coat, whips back the first sheet, which contains the XY scatterplot of Uncle Jeff and Auntie Anne, and notes down the coordinates of the console. Sound carries in the Palouse, and from the Origin he can hear Aunt Nina saying to Uncle Red, "How much of our Tau sub E have we just spent on that console?"
"If we leave everything else down here at Y equals 0, 100% after scaling," Uncle Red says. "Otherwise, it depends on how we distribute these things in the Y dimension."
Which is, of course, the correct answer, albeit totally useless. If these days in Whitman don't make Amy flee from Randy in terror, nothing will. And so he's glad, in a sick way, that she is seeing this. The subject of his family has not really come up until now. Randy is not given to talking about his family because he feels there is nothing to report. Small town, good education, shame, and self-esteem doled out in roughly equal quantities and usually were warranted. Nothing spectacular along the lines of grotesque psychopathologies, sexual abuse, massive shocking trauma, or satanic rallies in the backyard. So normally when people are talking about their families, Randy just shuts up and listens, feeling that he has nothing to say. His familial anecdotes are so tame, so pedestrian, that it would be presumptuous even to relate them, especially after someone else has just divulged something really shocking or horrific. But standing there and looking at these vortices, he starts to wonder. Some people's insistence that, "Today I smoke, am overweight, have a shitty attitude, am depressed because my mom died of cancer, my uncle put his thumb up my butt, my dad hit me with a razor strop," seems kind of overly deterministic to Randy. It seems to reflect a kind of lazy or half-witted surrender to bald teleology. Basically, if everyone has a vested interest in believing that they understand everything, or even that people are capable in principle of understanding it, either because believing this dampens their insecurities about the unpredictable world or makes them feel more intelligent than others, or both, then you have an environment in which dopey, reductionist, simple-minded, pat, glib thinking can circulate like wheelbarrows filled with inflated currency in the marketplaces of Jakarta. But things like the ability of some student's dead car to spawn repeating patterns of thimble-sized vortices 100 yards downwind would seem to argue in favor of a more cautious view of the world, an openness to the full and true weirdness of the universe, an admission of our limited human faculties. And if you've gotten to this point, then you can argue that growing up in a family devoid of gigantic and obviously primal psychological forces and living a life touched by many subtle and even forgotten influences, rather than one or two biggies, for example, active participation in the Church of Satan, can lead, far downwind, to consequences that are not entirely devoid of interest. Randy hopes, but very much doubts, that America Shafto, sitting up there in the algae-colored light reading about the inadvertent extermination of the cayuse, sees it this way. Randy rejoins his aunt at the Origin. Uncle Red has been explaining to her, somewhat condescendingly, that they must pay careful attention to the distribution of items on the economic scale, and for his troubles, he has been sent on a long, lonely walk down the positive X-axis, carrying the complete silver tea service. "Why couldn't we just have stayed inside and worked this all out on paper?" Aunt Nina asks.
It was felt that there was value in physically moving this stuff around, giving people a direct physical analog of the value assertions that they were making, Randy says. Also that it would be useful to appraise this stuff literally in the cold light of day,
as opposed to 10 or 12 emotionally fraught people clambering around a packed-to-the-ceiling U-Storit locker with flashlights, sniping at each other from behind the armoires.
Once we've made all our choices, then what? You sit down and figure it out on a spreadsheet or something?
It is much too computationally intensive to be solved that way. Probably a genetic algorithm is called for. Certainly there won't be a mathematically exact solution. My father knows a researcher in Geneva who has done work on problems isomorphic to this one and sent him email last night. With any luck, we will be able to FTP some suitable software and get it running on the Terra.
The Terra?
Terra, as in teraflops?
That does me no good at all. When you say as in, you are supposed to give me something more familiar to relate it to.
It is one of the 10 fastest computers on the planet. Do you see that red brick building just to the right of the end of the negative y-axis? Randy says, pointing down the hill. Just behind the new gym?
Oh, the one with all the antennas?
Yes. The Terra machine is in there. It was made by a company in Seattle.
It must have been very expensive.
My dad talked them out of it.
Yes,
says Uncle Red cheerfully, returning from high X-value territory.
The man is a legendary donation raiser.
He must have a persuasive side to him that I have not been perceptive enough to notice yet,
Aunt Nina says, wandering curiously toward some large cardboard boxes.
No,
Randy says. It's more like he just goes in and flops around on the conference table until they become so embarrassed for his sake that they agree to sign the check.
You've seen him do this,
Aunt Nina says skeptically, sizing up a box labeled Constituents of Upstairs Linen Closet.
Heard about it.
High Tech is a small town, Randy says.
He's been able to make great capital of his father's work, Uncle Red says. If my father had patented even one of his computer inventions, Palouse College would be bigger than Harvard, and so on.
Aunt Nina has got the box open now. It is almost completely filled by a single Tagmian blanket, in a dark grayish-brown on dark brownish-gray plaid. The blanket in question is about an inch thick, and during wintertime family reunions was infamous as a booby prize of sorts among the Waterhouse grandchildren. The smell of mothballs, mildew, and heavily oiled wool causes Aunt Nina's nose to wrinkle as it did Aunt Annie's before her. Randy remembers bedding down beneath this blanket once at the age of about 9 and waking up at 2 in the morning with bronchial spasms, hypothermia, and vague memories of a nightmare about being buried alive. Aunt Nina slams the box flaps shut, turns around, and looks in the direction of the Impala. Robin Shafto is already running towards them. Being not bad at math himself, he was quick to pick up on this whole concept, and knows from experience that the blanket box will have to be trundled deep out into negative X, negative Y territory.
I guess I'm just worried, Aunt Nina says, about having my preferences mediated by this supercomputer. I've tried to make it clear what I want, but will the computer understand that?
She has paused by the ceramics box in a way that is tantalizing Randy, who badly wants to have a look inside, but doesn't want to arouse suspicions. He's the referee, and is sworn to objectivity.
Forget the china, she says. Too old lady-ish.
Uncle Red wanders over and disappears behind one of the dead cars, presumably to take a leak. Aunt Nina says,
How about you, Randy? As the eldest son of the eldest son, you must have some feelings about this.
No doubt when my parents' time comes, they will pass on some of Grandma and Grandpa's legacy to me, Randy says.
Oh, very circumspect. Well done, Aunt Nina says. But as the only grandchild who has any memories of your grandfather at all, there must be something here that you might like to have.
Well, there'll probably be some odds and ends that nobody wants, Randy says. Then, like an almost perfect moron, like an organism genetically engineered to be a total stupid idiot, Randy glances directly at the trunk. Then he tries to hide it, which only makes it more conspicuous. He guesses that his mostly beardless face must be an open book, and wishes he had never shaved.
A bullet of ice strikes him in the right cornea with a nearly audible splot. The ballistic impact blinds him, and the thermal shock gives him an ice cream headache. When he recovers enough to see again, Aunt Nina is walking around the trunk, kind of spiraling in towards it in a rapidly decaying orbit.
What's in here?
She grips the handle at one end and finds she can barely get it off the ground.
Old Japanese code books, bundles of ETC cards.
Marcus?
Yes, ma'am,
says Marcus Aurelia Shafto, returning from the double negative quadrant.
What is the angle exactly in between the positive X and positive Y axes?
Aunt Nina asks.
I would ask the referee here, but I'm beginning to have doubts about his objectivity.
M.A. glances at Randy and decides he had best interpret this last comment as good-natured familial horsing around.
Would you like that in radians or degrees, ma'am?
Neither. Just demonstrate it for me. Take this great big trunk on that strong back of yours and just split the middle between positive X and positive Y axes and keep walking until I say when.
Yes, ma'am.
M.A. hefts the trunk and starts walking, frequently looking back and forth to verify that he's exactly in the middle. Robin stands off at a safe distance, watching with interest. Uncle Red, returning from his piss break, watches this in horror.
Nina, love! That's not worth the cost of shipping it home! What on earth are you doing?
Making sure I get what I want, Nina says.
Randy gets a small part of what he wants 2 hours later, when his own mother breaks the seal on the ceramics box to verify that the china is in good condition. At the time, Randy and his father are standing next to the trunk. It is rather late in the parents' value-plotting work, and so pieces of fine furniture are now widely scattered across the parking lot, looking like the aftermath of one of those tornadoes that miraculously sets things down intact after whirling them through the skies for 10 miles. Randy is trying to find a way to talk up the emotional value of this trunk without violating his oath of objectivity. The chances of anyone other than Nina ending up with this trunk are actually quite miserable, since she, to Red's horror, left almost everything clumped around the origin, except for it and the coveted console. But if Dad would at least move the thing off dead center, which no one except Nina has done, then, if the Terra awards it to him tomorrow morning, Randy can plausibly argue that it's something other than a computer error. But Dad is taking most of his cues from Mom and is having none of it. Mom has bitten her gloves off and is parting layer after layer of crumpled newsprint with magenta hands.
Oh, the gravy boat,
she exclaims, and hoists up something that is more of a heavy cruiser than a boat. Randy agrees with Aunt Nina that the design is old lady-ish in the extreme, but that's kind of tautological since he has only seen it in the house of his grandmother, who has been an old lady for as long as he has known her. Randy walks towards his mother with his hands in his pockets, still trying to play it cool for some reason. This obsession with secrecy may have gone a bit far. He has seen this gravy boat maybe 20 times in his life, always at family reunions, and seeing it now roils up a whole silt cloud of long-settled emotions. He reaches out, and Mom remits it to his mittened hands. He pretends to admire it from the side and then flips it over to read the words glazed on the bottom. Royal Albert, Lavender Rose. For a moment, he is sweating under a vertical sun, swaying to keep his balance on a rocking boat, smelling the neoprene of hoses and flippers. Then he's back in the Palouse. He begins thinking about how to sabotage the computer program to ensure that Aunt Nina gets what she wants, so that she'll give him what is rightfully his. Golgotha. Lieutenant Ninomaya reaches Boondock about 2 weeks after Godo Dango, accompanied by several bashed and scraped wooden cases.
"What is your specialty?"
asks Godo Dango, and Lieutenant Ninomaya responds by opening up one of the cases to reveal a surveyor's transit swaddled in clean oiled linen. Another case contains an equally perfect sextant. Godo Dango gawks.
The gleaming perfection of the instruments is a marvel. But even more marvelous is that they sent him a surveyor only 12 days after he requested one. Ninomaya grins at the look on his new colleague's face, revealing that he has lost all of his front teeth except for one, which happens to be mostly gold. Before any engineering can be done, all of this wilderness must be brought into the realm of the known. Detailed maps must be prepared, watersheds charted, soil sampled. For 2 weeks, Goto Dango has been going around with a pipe and a sledgehammer taking core samples of the dirt. He has identified rocks from the stream beds, estimated the flow rates of the Yamamoto and Tojo rivers, counted and cataloged trees. He has trudged through the jungle and planted flags around the approximate boundaries of the special security zone. The whole time, he's been worrying about having to perform the survey himself, using primitive, improvised tools. And all of a sudden, here is Lieutenant Ninomaya with his instruments. The three lieutenants, Goto, Mori, and Ninomaya, spent a few days surveying the flat, semi-open land straddling the lower Tojo River. The year, 1944, is turning out to be dry so far, and Mori does not want to construct his military barracks on land that will turn into a marsh after the first big rain. He is not concerned about the comfort of the prisoners, but he would at least like to ensure that they won't get washed away. The lay of the land is also important in setting up the interlocking fields of fire that will be necessary to put down any riots or mass escape attempts. They put Boondock's few enlisted men to work, gathering bamboo stakes, then drive these in to mark the locations of roads, barracks, barbed wire fences, guard towers, and a few carefully sited mortar emplacements from which the guards will be able to fill the atmosphere in any chosen part of the camp with shrapnel. When Lieutenant Goto takes Lieutenant Ninomaya up into the jungle, clambering up the steep valley of the Tojo, Lieutenant Mori must stay behind, in accordance with Captain Noda's orders. This is just as well, since Mori has his work cut out for him down below. The captain has granted Ninomaya a special dispensation to see the special security zone.
"Elevations are of supreme importance in this project," Goto Dango tells the surveyor on the way up.
They are burdened with surveying equipment and fresh water, but Ninomaya clambers up the rocky gulch of the half-parched river just as ably as Goto Dango himself.
"We will begin by establishing the level of Lake Yamamoto, which does not exist yet, and then work downwards from there."
"I have also been ordered to obtain the precise latitude and longitude," says Ninomaya.
Goto Dango grins.
"That's hard. There is nowhere to see the sun."
"What about the three peaks?"
Goto Dango turns to see if Ninomaya is joking, but the surveyor is looking intently up the valley.
"Your dedication sets a good example,"
Goto Dango says.
"Ah, this place is paradise compared to Rabaul."
"Is that where you were sent from?"
"Yes."
"How did you escape? It is cut off, isn't it?"
"It has been cut off for some time," Ninomaya says curtly.
Then he adds,
"They came and got me in a submarine."
His voice is husky and faint. Goto Dango is silent for a while. Ninomaya has a system all worked out in his head, which they put into effect the next week, after they have done a rough survey of the special security zone. Early in the morning, they hoist an enlisted man into a tree with a canteen, a watch, and a mirror. There is nothing special about this tree except for a bamboo stake recently driven into the ground nearby, labeled Main Drift. Then Lieutenants Ninomaya and Goto climb to the top of the mountain, which takes them about 8 hours. It is dreadfully arduous, and Ninomaya is shocked that Goto volunteers to go with him.
"I want to see this place from the top of Calvary,"
Goto Dango explains.
"Only then will I have the insight to perform my duty well."
On the way up, they compare notes. New Guinea versus New Britain. It seems that the latter's only saving grace is the settlement of Rabaul, a formerly British port, complete with a cricket oval, now the linchpin of Nipponese forces in Southwest Asia.
"For a long time, it was a great place to be a surveyor," Ninomaya says,
and describes the fortifications that they built there in preparation for MacArthur's invasion.
He has the draftsman's enthusiasm for detail, and at one point talks non-stop for an hour describing a particular system of bunkers and pillboxes, down to the last booby trap and glory hole. As the climb gets harder, the two vie with each other in belittling its difficulty. Goto Dango tells the tale of climbing over the snow-covered mountain range in New Guinea.
"Nowadays, on New Britain, we climb volcanoes all the time,"
Ninomaya says offhandedly.
"Why?"
"To collect sulfur."
"Sulfur? Why?"
"To make gunpowder."
After this, they don't talk for a while. Goto Dango tries to dig them out of a conversational hole.
"It'll be a bad day for MacArthur when he tries to take Rabaul."
Ninomaya trudges along silently for a bit, trying to control himself, and fails.
"You idiot," he says. "Don't you see? MacArthur isn't coming. There's no need."
"But Rabaul is the cornerstone of the whole theater."
"It is a cornerstone of soft, sweet wood in a universe of termites,"
Ninomaya snaps.
"All he has to do is ignore us for another year, and then everyone will be dead of starvation or typhus."
The jungle thins out. The plants are wrestling for footholds on a loose slope of volcanic cinders, and only smaller ones endure. This puts Goto Dango in the mind of writing a poem in which the small, tenacious Nipponese prevail over the big, lumbering Americans. But it has been a long time since he wrote a poem, and he can't make the words go together. Someday the plants will turn this cone of scoria and rubble into soil, but not yet. Now that Goto Dango can finally see more than a few yards, he is beginning to understand the lay of the land. The numerical data that he and Ninomaya have compiled over the last week is being synthesized, within his mind, into a solid understanding of how this place works. Calvary is an old cinder cone. It started as a fissure from which ash and scoria were ejected, one fragment at a time, for thousands of years, tumbling up and outwards in a family of mortar-shell-like parabolic curves, varying in height and distance depending on the size of each fragment and the direction of the wind. They landed in a wide ring centered on the fissure. As the ring grew in height, it naturally spread out into a broad truncated cone with a central pit gouged out of its top, with the spitting fissure in the bottom of that pit. The winds here tend to come from a little bit east of due south, and so the ash tended to be pushed towards the north by northwest edge of the cone's rim. That is still the highest point of the cinder cone. But the fissure died out eons ago, or perhaps was plugged by its own emissions, and the whole structure has been much eroded since then. The southern rim of the cone is just a barrier of low hills perforated by the courses of the Yamamoto River and the two tributaries that come together to form the Tojo River. The central pit is a bowl of loathsome jungle, so saturated with chlorophyll that it looks black from above. Birds cruise above the canopy, looking like colored stars from up here. The northern rim still rises a good 500 meters above the bowl of jungle, but its formerly smooth arc has been dissected by erosion to form three distinct summits, each one a pile of rich scoria half-concealed by a stubble of green vegetation. Without discussion, Ninomaya and Goto Dango head for the one in the middle, which is the highest. They reach it at about 2:30 in the afternoon and immediately wish they hadn't, because the sun is beating almost straight down on top of them. But there is a cool breeze up here, and once they have protected their heads with makeshift burnouses, it's not so bad. Goto Dango sets up the tripod and the transit, while Ninomaya uses his sextant to shoot the sun. He has a pretty good German watch, which he zeroed against the radio transmission from Manila this morning, and this enables him to reckon the longitude. He works the calculation out on a scrap of paper on his lap, then goes back and does it again to double-check the numbers, speaking them out loud. Goto Dango copies them down in his notebook, just in case Ninomaya's notes get lost. At 3 o'clock sharp, the enlisted man down in the tree begins to flash his mirror at them. A brilliant spark from a dark rug of jungle that is otherwise featureless. Ninomaya centers his transit on this signal and takes down more figures. In combination with various other data from maps, aerial photos, and the like,
This should enable him to make an estimate of the main shaft's latitude and longitude.
"I don't know how accurate this will be," he frets, as they trudge down the mountain. "I have the peak exactly. What did you call it? Cavalry?"
"Close enough."
"This means soldiers on horseback, correct?"
"Yes."
"But the sight of the shaft I will not have very precisely unless I can use better techniques."
Goto Dengo considers telling him that this is perfectly all right, that the place was made to be lost and forgotten, but he keeps his mouth shut. The survey work takes another couple of weeks. They figure out where the shore of Lake Yamamoto will be and calculate its volume. It will be more of a pond than a lake, less than 100 meters across, but it will be deceptively deep, and it will hold a lot of water. They calculate the angle of the shaft that will connect the bottom of the lake to the main network of tunnels. They figure out where all of the horizontal tunnels will emerge from the walls of the Toja River's gorge and stake out the routes of roads and railways that will lead to those openings, so that debris can be removed and precious war material brought in for storage. They double and triple-check all of it to make sure that no fragment of the works will be visible from the air. Meanwhile, down below, Lieutenant Mori and a small work detail have planted some fence posts and strung some barbed wire, just enough to contain 100 or so prisoners who arrive packed into a couple of military trucks. When these are put to work, the camp expands very rapidly. The military barracks go up in a few days, and the double barbed wire perimeter is completed. They never seem to lack for supplies here. Dynamite comes in by the truckload, as if it weren't desperately needed in places like Rabaul, and is carefully stored under the supervision of Goto Dengo. Prisoners carry it into a special shed that has been constructed for this purpose in the shade of the jungle. Goto Dengo has not been close to the prisoners before and is startled to realize that they are all Chinese, and they are not speaking the dialect of Canton or Formosa, but rather one that Goto Dengo heard frequently when he was posted in Shanghai. These prisoners are northern Chinese. It is stranger and stranger all the time, this boondock place. The Filipinos, he knows, have been uniquely surly about their inclusion in the greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere. They are well-armed, and MacArthur has been egging them on. Many thousands of them have been taken prisoner. Within half a day's drive of boondock, there are more than enough Filipino prisoners to fill Lieutenant Mori's camp and accomplish Lieutenant Goto's project. And yet, the powers that be have shipped hundreds of Chinese people all the way down from Shanghai to do this work. At times like this, he begins to doubt his own sanity. He feels an urge to discuss the matter with Lieutenant Ninomaya, but the surveyor, his friend and confidant, has made himself scarce since his work was completed. One day, Goto Dengo goes by Ninomaya's tent and finds it empty. Captain Noda explains that the surveyor was called away suddenly to perform important work elsewhere. About a month later, when the road-building work in the special security zone is well underway, some of the Chinese workers who are digging begin shouting excitedly. Goto Dengo understands what they are saying. They have uncovered human remains. The jungle has done its work, and practically nothing is left but bones. But the smell and the legions of ants tell him that the corpse is a fairly recent one. He grabs a shovel from one of the workers and pulls up a scoop of dirt and carries it over to the river, dripping tangles of ants. He lowers it carefully into the running water. The dirt dissolves into a brown trail in the river, and the skull is soon revealed, the dome of the head, the eye sockets still not entirely empty, the nasal bone with some fragments of cartilage still attached, and finally the jaws, pocked with old abscesses and missing most of their teeth, except for one gold tooth in the middle. The current turns the skull over slowly, as if Lieutenant Ninomaya is hiding his face in shame, and Goto Dengo sees a neat hole punched through the base of the skull. He looks up. A dozen Chinese are gathered above him on the riverbank, watching him impassively.
"Do not speak of this to any of the other Nipponese," Goto Dengo says.
Their eyes go wide and their lips part in astonishment as they hear him speaking the precise dialect of Shanghai prostitutes. One of the Chinese workers is nearly bald. He seems to be in his 40s, though prisoners age rapidly, and so it is always difficult to tell. He is not scared like the others. He is looking at Gododengo appraisingly.
"You,"
Gododengo says,
"pick two other men and follow me. Bring shovels."
He leads them into the jungle, into a place where he knows there will be no further digging, and shows them where to put Lieutenant Ninomaya's new grave. The bald man is a good leader, as well as a strong worker, and he gets the grave dug quickly, then transfers the remains without squeamishness or complaint. If he has been through the China incident and survived for this long as a prisoner of war, he has probably seen and done much worse. Gododengo does his part by distracting Captain Noda for a couple of hours. They go up and tour the dam work on the Yamamoto River. Noda is anxious to create Lake Yamamoto as soon as possible, before MacArthur's Air Force makes detailed surveys of the area. The sudden appearance of a lake in the jungle would probably not go unnoticed. The site of the lake is a natural rock bowl covered by jungle, with the Yamamoto River running through the middle of it. Right next to the riverbank, men are already at work with rock drills, placing dynamite charges.
"The inclined shaft will start here," Gododengo tells Captain Noda. "And run straight."
Turning his back on the river, he makes one hand into a blade and thrusts it into the jungle.
"Straight down to Golgotha."
The place of the skull.
"Golgotha?"
Captain Noda says.
"It means hidden glade,"
Gododengo says authoritatively.
"Hidden glade. I like it. Very good. Golgotha,"
Captain Noda says.
"Your work is proceeding very well, Lieutenant Goto."
"I am only striving to live up to the high standard that was set by Lieutenant Ninomaya," says Gododengo.
"He was an excellent worker,"
Noda says evenly.
"Perhaps when I am finished here, I can follow him to wherever he was sent."
Noda grins.
"Your work is only beginning, but I can say with confidence that when you are finished, you will be reunited with your friend."
Seattle. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse's widow and five children agree that Dad did something in the war, and that's about all. Each of them seems to have a different 1950s B-movie or 1940s movie-tone newsreel in his or her head, portraying a rather different set of events. There is not even agreement on whether he was in the Army or the Navy, which seems like a pretty fundamental plot point to Randy. Was he in Europe or Asia? Opinions differ. Grandma grew up on an outback sheep farm. One might think, therefore, that at some point in her life, she might have been an earthy cuss, the type of woman who would not only remember which service her late husband had been in, but would be able to take down his rifle from the attic and field strip it blindfolded. But she had evidently spent something like 75% of her waking hours in church, where she not only worshipped, but went to school and transacted essentially all of her social life, or in transit thereto or therefrom. And her own parents quite explicitly did not want her to wind up living on a farm, ramming her arm up livestock vaginas and slapping raw steaks over the black eyes dished out by some husband. Farming might have been an adequate sort of booby prize for one or at most two of their sons, sort of a fallback for any offspring who happened to suffer major head injuries or fall into chronic alcoholism. But the real purpose of the Skamithid kids was to restore the past and lost glories of the family, who allegedly had been major wool brokers around the time of Shakespeare and well on their way to living in Kensington and spelling their names Smith, before some combination of scrapey, long-term climactic change, nefandous conduct by jealous outer Tagmians, and a worldwide shift in fashions away from funny-smelling 30-pound sweaters with small arthropods living in them, had driven them all into honest poverty and then not-so-honest poverty and led to their forcible transportation to Australia.
The point here being that Grandma was incarnated, indoctrinated, and groomed by her Ma to wear stockings and lipstick and gloves in a big city somewhere. The experiment had succeeded to the point where Mary Skimithid could, at any point in her post-adolescent life, have prepared and served high tea to the Queen of England on 10 minutes' notice, flawlessly, without having to even glance in a mirror, straighten up her dwelling, polish any silver, or bone up on any etiquette. It had been a standing joke among her male offspring that Mom could walk unescorted into any biker bar in the world and simply by her bearing and appearance cause all ongoing fistfights to be instantly suspended, all grubby elbows to be removed from the bar, postures to straighten, salty language to be choked off. The bikers would climb over one another's backs to take her coat, pull her chair back, address her as ma'am, etc. Though it had never been performed, this biker bar scene was like a whole sort of virtual or notional comedy sketch that was a famous moment in entertainment for the Waterhouse family, like the Beatles on Ed Sullivan or Belushi doing a samurai bit on Saturday Night Live. It was up there on their mental video cassette shelves, right next to their imaginary newsreels and B-movies of what the patriarch had done in the war. The bottom line was that the ability to run a house in the way Grandma was legendary or infamous for doing, to keep the personal grooming up to that standard, to send out a few hundred Christmas cards every year, each written in flawless fountain pen longhand, etc., etc., that all of these things taken together took up as much space in her brain as, say, mathematics might take up in a theoretical physicist's. And so when it came to anything of a practical nature, she was perfectly helpless, and probably always had been. Until she had gotten too old to drive, she had continued to tool around Whitman in the 1965 Lincoln Continental, which was the last vehicle her husband had purchased, from Whitman's Patterson Lincoln Mercury before his untimely death. The vehicle weighed something like 6,000 pounds and had more moving parts than a silo full of Swiss watches. Whenever any of her offspring came to visit, someone would discreetly slip out to the garage to yank the dipstick, which would always be mysteriously topped up with clear amber-colored 10W-40. It eventually turned out that her late husband had summoned the entire living male lineage of the Patterson family, 4 generations of them, into his hospital room and gathered them around his deathbed and wrought some kind of unspecified pact with them, along the general lines of that if at any point in the future the tire pressure in the Lincoln dropped below spec or the maintenance in any other way lapsed, all of the Pattersons would not merely sacrifice their immortal souls, but literally be pulled out of meetings or lavatories and dragged off to hell on the spot, like Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. He knew that his wife had only the vaguest idea of what a tire was, other than something that from time to time a man would heroically jump out of the car and change while she sat inside the car admiring him. The world of physical objects seemed to have been made solely for the purpose of giving the men around Grandma something to do with their hands. And not, mind you, for any practical reason, but purely so that Grandma could twiddle those men's emotional knobs by reacting to how well or poorly they did it. Which was a fine setup, as long as men were actually around, but not so good after Grandpa died. So, guerrilla mechanic teams had been surveilling Randy's grandmother ever since, and occasionally swiping her Lincoln from the church parking lot on Sunday mornings, and taking it down to Patterson's for sub rosa oil changes. The ability of the Lincoln to run flawlessly for a quarter of a century without maintenance, without even putting gasoline in the tank, had only confirmed grandmother's opinions about the amusing superfluity of male pursuits. In any event, what it all came down to was that Grandma, whose grasp of practical matters had only declined, if that was even possible, with advanced age, was not the sort of person you would go to for information about her late husband's war record. Defeating the Nazis was in the same category as changing a flat tire, an untidy business that men were expected to know how to do. And not just the men of yore, the supermen of her generation. Randy was expected to know about these things, too. If the Axis reconstituted itself tomorrow, Grandma would expect Randy to be suited up behind the controls of a supersonic fighter plane the day after that. And Randy would sooner spiral into the ground at Mach 2 than bear her tidings that he wasn't up to the job. Luckily for Randy, who has recently become intensely curious about Grandpa, an old suitcase has been unearthed.
It's a rattan and leather thing. Sort of a snappy, roaring 20s number, complete with some badly abraded hotel stickers, plotting Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse's migration from the Midwest to Princeton and back, which is completely filled with small black-and-white photographs. Randy's father dumps the contents out on a ping-pong table that inexplicably sits in the center of the rec room at Grandma's managed care facility, whose residents are about as likely to play ping-pong as they are to get their nipples pierced. The photos are messed out into several discrete piles, which are in turn sorted through by Randy and his father and his aunts and uncles. Most of them are photos of the Waterhouse kids, so everyone's fascinated until they have found pictures of themselves at a couple of different ages. Then the pile of photos begins to look depressingly large. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse was evidently a shutterbug of sorts, and now his offspring are paying the price. Randy has a different set of motives, and so he stays there late, going through pictures by himself. 99 out of 100 are snapshots of Waterhouse brats from the 1950s, but some are older. He finds a photo of Grandpa in a place with palm trees, in a military uniform, with a big, white, disc-shaped officer's cap on his head. 3 hours later, he comes across a picture of a very young grandpa, really just a turkey-necked adolescent, costumed in grown-up clothes, standing in front of a gothic building with two other men. A grinning dark-haired chap who looks vaguely familiar, and an aquiline blonde fellow in rimless glasses. All three men have bicycles. Grandpa is straddling his, and the other two, perhaps considering this to be not so dignified, are supporting theirs with their hands. Another hour goes by, and then there's Grandpa in a khaki uniform with more palm trees in the background. The next morning, he sits down next to his grandmother, after she has finished her daily hour-long getting-out-of-bed ritual. "Grandmother, I found these two old photographs." He deals them out on the table in front of her, and gives her a few moments to switch contexts. Grandma doesn't turn on a dime conversationally, and besides, those stiff old lady corneas take a little while to shift focus.
"Yes, these are both Lawrence when he was in the service."
Grandmother has always had this knack for telling people the obvious in a way that is scrupulously polite, but that makes the recipient feel like a butthead for having wasted her time. By this point, she is obviously tired of IDing photographs, a tedious job with an obvious subtext of, "You're going to die soon, and we were curious, who is this lady standing next to the Buick?"
"A grandmother," Randy says brightly, trying to rouse her interest. "In this photo here, he is wearing a Navy uniform, and in this photo here, he is wearing an Army uniform."
Grandma Waterhouse raises her eyebrows and looks at him with the synthetic interest she would use if she were at a formal affair of some kind, and some man she had just met tried to give her a tutorial on tire changing.
"It is, I think, kind of unusual," Randy says, "for a man to be in both the Army and the Navy during the same war. Usually it's one or the other."
"Lawrence had both an Army uniform and a Navy uniform,"
Grandmother says, in the same tone she'd used to say he had both a small intestine and a large intestine.
"And he would wear whichever one was appropriate."
"Of course he would," Randy says.